And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with paleontologist and science writer Neil Shubin. He's an associate dean of biological sciences at the University of Chicago. And his latest book is The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. In essence, humans still have evidence of astronomical events which created our planet. And Neil Shubin joins us from Chicago. Welcome to you, Neil.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And great to have you with us. You know, it's so difficult to grasp the fact that our bodies show the entire 14 billion year history of our universe. Can we begin with some examples, like what do we share in common with rocks, or how are the stars written within us?
You bet. So first off, to say that, you know, our bodies show connections to over 3 billion years of the history of life, over 4 billion years of the history of planet, and over 13, almost 14 billion years of the history of the universe. So, you know, seeing our history is like peeling an onion. You know, you see layer after layer of history inside of us, and there are artifacts of these events inside of us. So to summarize briefly, the atoms that make our bodies, the matter that makes us, from the hydrogen atoms and the oxygen atoms, carbon atoms, which make life possible, those arose, beginning the nuclei of those atoms arose in the Big Bang, and the atoms and the heavier nuclei arose in the fusion reactions of stars across the universe, and the heaviest ones arose in the explosion of stars and supernovae. So in a sense, the matter which makes us was originally, you know, citizens of the universe that came together at some point in us.
Right.
And after we die, after we pass, they will be returned to the universe to be part of other systems, other planets, perhaps other stars. So the atoms, atomic history of our bodies is actually the deepest. That's the one that relates to, you know, the Big Bang and stars. But then as we get to ever more recent events, we can begin to trace our history in the molecules, the combinations of those atoms, such as the water and the other the proteins and so forth that make us. And then our organs and physiological workings of our body, the processes that make life possible and that we use every day, I'm using right now to talk to you with, they arose in the interactions with the planet. So we can see evidence of this in rocks, we can see evidence of this in planets, and we can see evidence of this in stars.
So dust to dust is an apt funeral expression.
Yeah. And, you know, just give you one example. Here's just, I mean, when you can ask a question, okay, what's the connection of the solar system inside our bodies? Well, if you look inside our bodies, what you'll find is each of the 2 trillion cells that make us up have in their nuclei and in the workings of their DNA and proteins a clock inside of it. And that clock is based on the activity of DNA and proteins that rise and fall during the course of the day. Now, those clocks aren't just tuned to any random cycle. They're tuned to a virtual 24-hour cycle. And so much of our health depends on the working of those clocks. You know, our susceptibility to certain diseases comes about if we disrupt those clocks in some ways. There was a study that came out very recently that showed shift workers who work at the graveyard shift, you know, midnight till 8 in artificial light, have a tendency to develop certain kinds of diseases, and particularly certain kinds of cancers, actually. Sunlight at different kinds of day has different effects in our body. So if you try to suntan late in the day, the mechanisms of DNA repair make it much more likely that the mutations that cause cancer will crop up later in the day. So the safest sun exposure is early in the day. And that's all based on our clocks, and that's all based on the fact that we have inside of us this deep tie to the spinning of the Earth and the rotation of the moon about it inside all the 2 trillion clocks inside of our bodies.
Mm. How about the body clock that controls our aging, and as we grow older we become more wrinkled and such?
Yeah, we have clocks on clocks inside of us, and each of us have that aging clock built into our chromosomal structure, which is an annual kind of clock. And it's different for many people, and it's different for many species. And each species is programmed to die at a different age. You know, and that's based on many ecological factors, but we're just beginning to come to grips with that.
What do you mean it's based on ecological factors, each species?
Yeah, so natural selection, so evolution by natural selection, acts on many properties of organisms. It acts on your success in a particular environment, most notably your success in reproducing with offspring. So some species, it's much more beneficial to reproduce early, and others, it's much more viable to reproduce continually throughout a life for long periods of time. So based on how selection acts on that, that will dictate, in part, the lifespan or what's called the senescence of the animal. But that's also based on a form of clock. And I should say these clocks are just so unbelievably profound. And, it's related, as we go look at the astronomical events, that's one of our deepest ties to the actual solar system itself. But there are others indeed.
So can we go back for a moment? You and a colleague made that great discovery in 2004. I'll try and pronounce it, the Toctalic rosae.
You got it. Very good.
All right. So what interested you in finding it? It's a fossil.
Yeah.
And what did it reveal?
Yeah, okay. So I am, I was trained as a paleontologist, right? And I, one of the puzzles that always excited me as a paleontologist was understanding the big events of evolution, like the transition from life in water to life on land. That struck me as a really huge event. You have fish live in water. It's a very different environment than land. And so the idea was to understand this transition. Could we find new fossils that, in a sense, bridge this this gap in evolution? We had a number of fossils at the time. This is in the late 80s. So we set off, my colleague Ted Deschler, close friend and colleague in all this, who was in Philadelphia, we set off to find fossils. And what we did is we looked around the world for places that would have the rocks of the right age to answer this question, places that would have the right kinds of rock to answer this question, and places in the world where those rocks would be exposed to the surface, where we could actually see them rather than, dig miles underground.
Right.
It turned out the best place for this hunt was in the Canadian Arctic, in a place known as Ellesmere Island, where it's 700 miles from the North Pole. There are polar bears up there. It's daylight 24 hours a day. It's really adventurous, which was kind of shocking for me because I'm a little suburban guy from Philadelphia, and so camping was never my strong suit. But here I am leading expeditions way up in the Arctic. We worked about 6 years up there and eventually found what we were looking for, which was a creature, Toctalic, as you said, which is about 4 feet long. It's a fossil in rocks about 375 million years of age. Hmm. Like a land-living, like a fish, it has scales in its back and fins with thin webbing. But when we looked at the animal, we found it had a neck, unlike any fish, right? So it really has a neck like a land-living animal. And when we took the fin apart, it has bones that correspond to our upper arm, forearm, even parts of our wrist. So a real mix between a creature that lived in water and creature that invaded land.
Neil Schumann,
and,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, my first book, called Your Inner Fish, was actually looking at why that fossil is actually relevant to our own evolutionary history. And it becomes clear that many of the features that evolved in the transition from life in water to life in land are actually part of our own anatomy today. The ones that I'm using to talk to you with right now, and every time I bend my wrist or shake my head using my neck, we can thank Toctalic and its evolutionary cousins for that.
And what were the conditions on the planet at the time of Toctalic?
Yeah, very, very different. We tend to look at the planet today and think that's how it's always been. There was no ice at the poles, so it's a very warm planet. There was not as much latitudinal variation in climate, so a lot of the Earth was a lot like Key West, fortunately, for the creatures that live there. The continents were differently disposed. So where Ellesmere Island is today, it's up near Greenland. Back then, it was much closer to the equator. So the continents have moved around, and so things were. The world inside the rocks of the Canadian Arctic at this time was very tropical, subtropical. So different place, man. Our world has seen such revolution, over geological time. Our planet's just changed so much.
You mentioned in the book about how even a child can tell that there's a relationship, say, between South America and the curvature of Africa, that the continents.
Yeah, I show, I have an 11-year-old son. And, when I was writing Universe Within and I was doing the Continental Drift chapter, I gave him the globe and I said, what do you see? What does this look like to you? And, he described it as a jigsaw puzzle, just like most kids. Most people look at it and they say, hey, those continents kind of fit together. Yet that kind of thinking was, in scientific circles, utter heresy, you know, for years, that the continents were eventually connected. And it really was because of scientific research that happened after the Cold War that has become our dominant view.
When you mentioned the Big Bang, well, I don't know if we have time. We need to go to a little break, but I'd like you to talk about the Big Bang, what it is, and the consequences of it. Should we go to our break first?
No, why don't we take the question first,
okay.
Then we go to the
break. All right. So what is the Big Bang, and what were the consequences?
Well, the Big Bang is when the expansion of the universe, as we know it, began. So we can actually time since the Big Bang. The entire universe was in a single point that consisted of high temperatures and high energies. We actually don't understand much of what the world, the universe, looked like at that moment, because our laws of physics and the means we had didn't appear yet. The universe begins to become clearer to our knowledge in the seconds after the Big Bang, when the forces that we come to know and love, like electromagnetism and the forces that attract elements and subatomic particles and so forth.
And gravity?
Yeah, gravity came later, about a million years after the Big Bang, at least the effects of gravity. You needed big particles first to stick together. So what happened is after the Big Bang, you had an expansion of the universe, rapid expansion of the universe, and eventual cooling of things. So as the universe expanded and cooled, the world as we know it emerged. First, subatomic particles came together to make atomic nuclei. Then electrons were caught into that orbit to make atoms. Then as gravity began to take over, as you get bigger and bigger particles, we started to get ever larger association of matter, which includes stars and the fusion reactions of them. So what we see is over a period of, you know, several million years to 100 million years after the Big Bang, we begin to see our universe emerge in a form that we would recognize it.
I take it you're not a fan of intelligent design.
No, I don't think it's I don't think it gives us many tools for discovery. You know, so my job is discovery, to go out and find fossils and new entities, and any tool that gets in the way of discovery is not something that I use.
We're speaking with Neil Shubin. He's a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist. And his latest book is The Universe Within. We're on Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Neil Shubin. He's a paleontologist, and he's written The Universe Within, and he's joining us from Los Angeles. If you'd like to join in, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
So we're back, and why was Earth able to develop life as we know it?
You know, you look at the circumstances that have promoted life, first its origin and later its evolution. It comes down to this is a wonderfully moderate planet in many ways. We are more or less the right distance from the sun, so we're not too hot, not too cold, and it can support liquid water, and that liquid water exists for the most part as liquid state across the Earth, but in ice in other parts and water vapor in others. And that liquid water is actually a really important part of a general process, and that is that water is not only a wonderful matrix to do chemical reactions, which are so essential for life. You think about our bodies. You know, we rely so much on water as a matrix for the way our atoms and molecules interact with one another in physiological processes. But also water is not only a great matrix to regulate bodies, but it's a great matrix, an important matrix, for regulating the health of the planet. Because the ways that atoms, such as carbon, which is so important for global temperatures, oxygen, which is so important for life and fueling the fires of life, the way they cycle through our planet depends very much as water, as a mediator. The water of the oceans, the water in the air, the water in rain. These things form a circulatory system, if you will, for many of the atoms of which are so important for the workings of the planet itself. So water at the level of life, water at the level of the planet, and those are linked. Earth and life are terrifically linked, and those are linked to our sort of fortunate position in our distance from the sun and our relationship to the other planets in the solar system.
So it was just by chance that we were able to develop life, a lot based on our position and the fact that we're able to have water.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, chance is a funny word. It certainly is our good fortune, but it's also chances of very and good fortune is temporary, because in over a billion years the sun is going to evolve. It's burning through its hydrogen fuel. At some point, its hydrogen fuel will get depleted. It'll start burning another fuel in its fusion reactions. As it does that, it'll get larger and hotter, and the Earth will no longer be habitable for life. And perhaps the next, you know, areas for life will be further out in the solar system, maybe moons of Saturn like Enceladus, or moons of Jupiter like Europa.
And
we'll all be long.
Our good fortune really is only a moment in time.
We'll all be long gone by then, though.
Yeah, you know, we got a little time to figure that one out.
So do we share any similarities with other planets?
Oh, you bet. Yeah, you bet. I mean, so other planets have water. You know, so Venus and Mars are our closest neighbors, and they're kind of our evil twins, if you will, in some ways, in different ways. I mean, Venus shows the situation if you're too close to the sun. Venus, at some point in its past, lost its water and has entered sort of a green, so it lost its circulatory system that we have in the Earth. And what happened is it's completely out of whack. It now is a total greenhouse planet with surface temperatures over 800 degrees. Mars is sort of on the opposite end of the extreme. It's a little colder, and so in that sense, it's frozen many of the internal processes that are so important for maintaining that circulatory system of the planet again, the internal fires that drive the movement of the continents and so forth. So, again, we learn a lot by looking at our neighbors, and that's why these Mars missions and the missions we originally sent to Venus were so unbelievably illuminating for our own situation.
Neil Shubin, tell us about the, quote, big whack and the origin of the moon. And
yeah, the big thwack, yeah. I mean, so the origin of the moon is a major event in the history of our planet and very important for life. Let's just first stop and think about what the moon gives us. Obviously, it gives us gorgeous, aesthetically beautiful moonlit evenings. But more importantly, it gives us the tides. It defines, with the rotation or the spinning of the Earth, the length of our days and how they change over time. The moon is very important in our basic biology and indeed in the biology for life on Earth. Just think of the importance of tides. Just look out, you know, in the bay and see just what that drives. And indeed, over time, it's been important there. Now, we've learned a lot of lessons studying the moon, and some of those lessons have really come from the Apollo space program. I should say right off the bat, you know, I was 8 years old when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and that had a profound impact on me. Just seeing the national pride of having our astronauts on the moon, but more importantly, having people sort of where the moon became knowable. That those moon rocks came home to us, and. And after they came home, they entered labs to study, many important labs in Caltech, University of Chicago, and elsewhere, studied those moon rocks. And in the chemistry of those moon rocks, they discovered over the years something really cool, which is the moon rocks are not hugely different from Earth rocks in the chemical signature of some of their important atoms, which suggested that the moon, when it formed in more or less the same orbit as the Earth. That and some other data suggests one hypothesis for the origin of the moon is that at some point, as the Earth was beginning to form about 4 billion years ago, a giant, and by giant I mean Mars-sized asteroid, hit the Earth, whacked the forming Earth, vaporized much of the outer crust into a dust layer, and that part of that dust layer later congealed as the moon. And that surprising hypothesis is supported by the chemistry of the rocks in several ways, but also in terms of some of the physics of some of the orbits. I think that's the most accepted current theory for the origin of the moon. There are others, but that's the one that seems to have the most support from the current data.
Let's take a call or two on our program. This is Tom in Miami. Thanks for your patience, Tom.
Oh, not a problem. Thank you. I'm actually really excited to ask this question because I am a little bit younger than you are, sir, and I remember Cosmos fondly. I'm in the Cosmos generation and was very excited when I heard about the Drake equation. But relating to the question you just asked about the source of life, and it's kind of a fuzzy question, my question is, do you support the panspermia hypothesis, meaning that not only did organic molecules rain down in comets, but possibly biologically derived organic molecules? And I guess the furthest extent of that is some people say that things like water bears or tardigrades actually possibly came on in comets. But do you believe in panspermia, or do you think that the basic chemicals were here and everything else just semi-auto-derived post?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really fabulous question. Now, the question he asks is did life, you know, was life seeded on our planet through sort of meteor impacts or other kinds of interactions with the solar system, or did it arrive indigenously? So to understand that, first of all, we're getting into the origin of life question. And when we get to that, we're like, what's our evidence for the origin of life? Now, there's a lot we do not know. Because those molecules do not fossilize, so our knowledge is indirect. It's based on trying to simulate our early Earth conditions to make the molecules. So in terms of what we know is that life got going very quickly on our planet. If the planet's over 4.5 billion years old, the first evidence for life is 3.3 or so billion years, meaning life probably got going well before that, you know, well before we actually have the evidence for it. So think of that, you know? I mean, within a paltry, you know, few hundred million years after the origin of the planet, you have life and water. And then it took another 3.5 billion years for conscious life, but that's another question. So life actually happened very quickly. So what were the conditions that allowed that? So one scenario is it was seeded either directly by sort of replicating molecules arriving from space, or indirectly by having the components of those molecules arriving and forming indigenously. The simple answer to that question is I don't know. My gut feeling, however, in terms of where the evidence lies at the current time, is that the more we try to simulate the early Earth in test tubes in the laboratory, seeding with molecules, the more we find that very complex molecules that have some properties of nucleic acids can spontaneously come about in the right conditions. And the real question is, are those conditions true mimics for what happened on Earth? But I tell you, you know, we're living in exciting times. We are really living in exciting times. The techniques of chemistry are getting ever more powerful to answer these questions. And just think about, you know, Mars Curiosity, the rover that landed on Mars last August, and that beautifully complicated landing that went without a hitch, you know, which was a source of incredible pride, and for the scientists who did it and all of us who watched, that is now a working geochemical laboratory on another planet. I mean, this is a fabulous time to be interested in these questions, because I have a feeling within the next few years we're going to have a lot more answers. Answers to whether life, the conditions for life exist on Mars, whether life itself existed on Mars at some point in time, whether the environment of Mars was able to support life, which may relate to the listener's question directly.
Right. We're speaking with Neil Shubin. He's a paleontologist and associate dean of biological sciences at the University of Chicago. His newest book is The Universe Within. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take another break. Please stay with us, and we'll return in a moment.
And we return, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, today's Topical Currents. We resume our conversation with Neil Shubin. His book is The Universe Within. Neil, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Yeah, there's a couple. You can do tiktaalik, .uchicago.edu. That's T-I-K-T-A-A-L-I-K, tiktaalik, .uchicago, one word, .edu. That tells all about the fossil, how we found it, and contains links to understand more about geological history. And then neilshubin.com is a general website for Universe Within. And that will have links to other resources on the web and so forth that should be useful for listeners if they want to explore more.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to explore more with Neil Shubin, that's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Neil Shubin, could you address some of the catastrophes that the Earth has endured, including What killed off the dinosaurs?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, if you take every fossil we've ever discovered as paleontologists, right, and those fossils span over, you know, hundreds of millions of years of geological time, and lay them out in front of you, okay, it'd be a big, you know, many football fields worth of fossils, indeed a small city's worth, but, and you laid them out in some sort of temporal sequence, you know, over time, over the last, say, 600 million years, what you would see would patterns would emerge. You know, and a lot of people crunch the data on those things to find what patterns exist. But one pattern you really wouldn't have to crunch much data to see would be there'd be certain periods of time, there are about five of them, which are truly catastrophic, where life disappears around the globe very rapidly in all kinds of different living forms. And some of these have been truly catastrophic. They've been reasonably rapid in the geological, you know, in geological terms at least, happening in the order of, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. They've resulted in the loss of many species. Indeed, one of the most dramatic of these events happened over 225 million years ago, and it led to over 95% of the species around, up to 99 even, going extinct. So life almost, you know, disappeared in some of these events. Now, one of these events happened over 65 million years ago, and it's the one we all kind of know about, which is the demise of the dinosaurs. Now, the dinosaurs were only one kind of creature that went out at that time. There were creatures living in the seas. There were creatures living on land, all of which disappeared at the same time. So naturally, this, to many paleontologists and geologists, was a huge scientific puzzle, right? I mean, what's the trigger? What's the smoking gun for these catastrophes? And folks have searched for a number of different mechanisms that can cause such rapid and complete global change. Among those kinds of mechanisms were volcanism, you know, lots of volcanoes that would change the atmosphere. But the real game changer in terms of explanatory power was the proposal in the late 70s, early 80s, that perhaps a large asteroid hit the Earth, we know they do from time to time, but if they're sufficiently large, they could vaporize and change the global atmosphere and climate in such a way that could cause a global economic catastrophe that would ultimately result in the demise of many species in different environments. And that was proposed, it was very controversial, but the beautiful thing about that notion is it is testable, that is, we could see whether that is correlated, that such an asteroid event is correlated in time with the extinctions. And it turns out, not only is that true, yes, but there also is a likely asteroid impact site in the Yucatan in Mexico. So in terms of explaining that particular extinction, that catastrophe, the demise of the dinosaurs, the asteroid theory seems to reign supreme. For the others, not so much. There may be other mechanisms involved. I should say that the consequences of that particular extinction event are, I think, very important for us, because there's every reason to suppose that our very existence actually depended on that asteroid hitting the Earth, because our distant ancestors, the mammals who lived with the dinosaurs at the time, they were small, not very diverse, and it was really only after dinosaurs were removed from the scene that that the mammals, our lineage, came to flourish. So by some reckoning, I think it's not implausible to say that thank you, asteroid, for allowing our existence, to making it possible in the first place.
So are all life forms subject to extinction? I mean, including human beings?
Yeah, you know, that's the bad news. Yeah, I knew somebody would go there. Yeah.
Or cockroaches.
And when you're a paleontologist, the one thing you do know seems to be the law. Just like every individual dies, every individual species has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Hmm.
Now, that end can happen in different ways. That end can happen by outright extinction with no descendants, or that end can happen by transmutation, where you give rise to something new that eventually takes over the Earth. So, you know, there's a bright side and a downside to that, but the good news is we as a species are continually changing. We have it in our power to make decisions that can better our future. Let's see if we do it. But, I mean, we actually do have it in our power. We're not always good at executing.
Right.
But certainly that's the lesson you learn from paleontology.
And let's take another call or two. Next up, it's a Boynton Beach caller. This is John. Hey, John.
Good afternoon. How's everyone today?
Good.
Good.
Good. Great. I have a question. I've been on hold so long, I kind of forgot how to phrase it. Correct me, so pardon me. The deepest pictures that Hubble has taken to date, I think, take us back to about 300 million years after the Big Bang. And when we look at these photos, we see, and I won't number them, but numerous existing galaxies, correct, in these photos.
Okay.
So the question is, when we go back to that standpoint in time, and we're seeing numerous existing galaxies that already are there, doesn't that imply that the Big Bang effect, as we define it, is a localized event?
No, I mean, because one thing you have is, first off, is the rates of change are very rapid. You know, when you're dealing with those first hundreds of million years after the Big Bang, it's pretty clear that things are changing very quickly. You know, the game changer is the formation of fusion reactions in stars, which sort of really sets everything apart. And then, but the other piece of it is that when we look at the universe and what's being one of the really exciting projects that's going on now is one that's called the Dark Energy Camera, and it is actually to map those regions of space which you're talking about. What they've done is they've developed the world's largest, this is actually folks at the University of Chicago working with others in Chile and in the University of California, developing the world's largest digital camera. And it's a digital camera that has, you know, this giant chip, so it can record all kinds of light information that would be invisible to other kinds of cameras. And what they did is they just set this thing up about, it took several years, making it sound easy, but it wasn't, on the top of a mountain in Chile, which is some of the clearest seeing air to see the sky in the Atacama Desert, to map the entire sky, including some of those regions you're talking about. And so as we speak, they're collecting the data on those distant galaxies. And one thing we're finding things that make a whole lot of sense, and some things that are real mysteries that we don't understand. The things that are making a lot of sense are that there has been an expansion of the universe, and that the universe, and this is one of the surprising things, is accelerating in its rate of expansion. So it's not so over time, we're accelerating faster now than we were in the past. And that sets up one of the great mysteries, which we don't really know much about, and I think in the next 10 years, this project like the Dark Energy Camera will tell us about, would be, you know, what's driving that acceleration? And right now we have this theoretical concept called dark energy, and another one called dark matter, which just means things we don't understand yet entirely, that pervade the universe and are generating that expansion. So cosmologists and astronomers are working on that problem, and the sort of the key piece of that will be very, very detailed maps of the sky, which will be made available over the next 5 years through projects, the Dark Energy Camera and other projects like that.
Okay, thanks for your call, John.
Well, I do have one follow-up, if I can.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, doesn't the fact that we are still expanding, and I see, understand the, and aware of the dark matter and the acceleration and such, doesn't that imply that we're going into areas where we have not previously been?
The universe? Well, that's the whole joy of science. I mean, that's what it's about. I mean, I don't want to go to areas I've been before. It's all about the unknown, and it's all about entering the unknown without fear, but with a great sense of responsibility and a knowledge that we as humans have the capacity to ultimately understand it. So I'm very optimistic.
And that brings us to another caller with a question, Jay in Pompano Beach.
Hello. This is another great program among your many. By the way, my name is on the back deck of the Curiosity on Mars on a microchip. But I do have a question for Neil, and that is, I've heard that the moon is moving away from the Earth at a rate of about half a minute to a minute away from the Earth per year. Is that true, and what are the ramifications for the future of our planet?
Okay, thank you so much. That's a great question. Yeah, the moon's moving away. What it's doing is we're in sort of a lock with sort of a angular momentum and energy lock with the moon, so that as the moon moves away, get this one, our days are actually getting shorter. So today is 2 milliseconds shorter about than yesterday. And yesterday was 2 milliseconds shorter than the day before it. You know, so you do that math. You know, our days, you know, our calendar's changing. You know, so we've lost. So the Earth slowed down about 22, the equivalent of about 22 days in the past 400 million years. At least that's the piece we can measure. We can measure that through corals, which give us an estimate of the length of the fossil corals, which give us an estimate of the length of the days in the past. So clearly the Earth is slowing down. Days are getting longer, and there are fewer days in the year. So come back in a million years, and you're going to need a whole bunch of new calendars.
We're speaking with Neil Shubin. His latest book is The Universe Within. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper and Professor Neil Shubin, a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist. He's Associate Dean of Biological Sciences at the University of Chicago, and his latest book is The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. I can't neglect to ask if you think we are experiencing global warming or climate change, and is that affecting
continents? It's human-induced.
Yes.
Yeah, human-induced, yeah. So we're definitely experiencing climate change. There's no doubt about that. And I think the preponderance of the evidence is that it's human-induced. I should say, my perspective on this is a little quirky in that, well, I'm not only a paleontologist and geologist, but, you know, I work up in the Arctic, and I go there every year, every other year, and I've been doing so for the last 25. Scary thought, actually. Working there that long.
Yes.
But anyway, there have been enormous amounts of change up there. And indeed, you know, I'm not alarmist by nature, actually, not at all. But the last time I went to the Arctic, it was so utterly different that alarm bells went off. And there was no ice in places we've worked in the previous years. The Inuit have changed their lifestyle. It never got, and this is in the summer, it's usually around freezing. It was about a good 10 degrees warmer that particular year. Now, that could have just been a weird year. But the retreat of the ice itself was alarming to see. You know, these were places in the 1800s that explorers got, you know, had to overwinter, and a number of expeditions were lost because of ice. So it was a really dramatic change. And if you look, sort of the hot spot, if you will, for climate change, is indeed the Arctic. That's data. We know that. Now the question is, what's driving that? Is it sort of natural variation in geological factors, or is it human induced? The thing is, we don't have any. We know one culprit. So carbon in the atmosphere is known to be a greenhouse gas, along with others, and it has an influence on global temperatures. And we've measured that in the past, both over geological time as well as recent. We don't know what other mechanism could be causing the change we have. So the main culprit seems to be carbon and human impacts. But that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of, you know, the problems we're setting up for ourselves environmentally. You know, you think of the development we have in wetlands and coastlands. Wetlands are very important for the recycling of nutrients and ecosystems. So our development and many of the choices we make in terms of agriculture and elsewhere we have impacts on ecology, on the globe, and on climate. So, yeah, I mean, carbon is definitely a player. When you study the geological past, it becomes very clear that over geological time frames, carbon is extremely important. But there's also short time frames where carbon is very important, and that's what's relevant for us as a species.
Neil Shubin, could you briefly tell us the story of, perhaps I'm not pronouncing this correct, but Michel Siffre, 1963, and the conception of elapsed time?
That blew my mind in the book. Michel Siffre is the French way of saying it. He's a geologist, right? So Siffre was a geologist, and he had an idea. His hobby was spelunking. He loved caves. So he had an idea for this wacky experiment, and it proved to be brilliant, which was, okay, I'm going to go into a cave for 60 days, you know, 2 months, with no day and night. So he's going to completely disconnect not only from the solar and lunar clock, you know, underground, but disconnect from any clock, any notion of time whatsoever. So all the clocks, anything that would give a sense of time, non-biological, was left on the surface. And he hooked himself up to all kinds of monitors, so, you know, his physiology, you know, his appetite, when he ate, when he went to bed. I mean, all these things were recorded, and in absence of a clock. And he would had a telephone that was connected to his friends on the surface, and he didn't have a clock, but he would tell them, you know, I'm going to bed now. And he'd call, you know, when he woke up, he'd call them again, I'm waking up. So they would record that on a clock, even despite the fact that he didn't have it. So he was completely disconnected with the clock, and his friends were monitoring him. And he's in this experiment, and he's talking to his friends one day. His friends say, hey, how much notice do you want for this experiment, for, you know, before you have to be called up? And he says, give me 2 days. They said, sorry, you're coming up tomorrow. He had lost, by his reckoning, I think about 22 to 30 days.
Oh.
And the reason for that is he disconnected from the solar cycle and went on this cycle, like most of us sleep, you know, 7 or 8 hours and are awake, you know, 16 or 17 hours. He went on a 12-hour cycle, more or less, a little bit more, creeped up a little bit. But he's completely disconnected, but he stayed on a virtual 24, 25, 26-hour cycle of his day. Turns out when those data were crunched, his body kept on a 24-hour clock. So despite the fact that he wasn't, you know, attuned to a clock, his body was very much on a clock. And that was one of the sort of founding experiments for much of sleep research, for looking at the human effects of the clocks and the bodies, its health consequences. And indeed, that discovery couldn't have happened at a better time, because that's just when geneticists working on flies and hamsters and other creatures began to discover the genetic basis for the clocks in other species.
Hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a really incredible story.
Yeah, it is. Where do you go from here? Do you have any new discoveries in the offing, or are you just focusing on this work for now?
No, I'm actually taking off on a new adventure. For me, the joy of paleontology is the thrill of the hunt. And so we're going back to the Arctic this summer, and we're going to be looking for new fossils. These fossils we're going to be looking at are older than Tiktaalik, so at an earlier stage of evolution, when we believe some of the first bodies came about, you know, creatures that actually have a cellular organization came about in the fossil record. So I, as a scientist, love a new challenge, I love a new hunt, and that's what we're beginning this summer. It's going to be a whole new learning process for me again, and I got to start over, but that's why it's kind of fun. It keeps you fresh.
So what years are you talking about now that you're going back?
520 million years old. So I was working on rocks that were 375. These are rocks that we have good data to suggest are between 500 and 520 million years old. And so it's, you know, it's back to the books. It's back to school for me.
Wow. You know,
I was expert on this one transition. Now I got to sort of learn a whole new one.
Why is the
Arctic? Yeah, that's what keeps you fresh.
Why is the Arctic so important in these studies?
Yeah, it's a really good question. My wife asks that a lot because it's, you know, it'd be much better if I was working in Miami. But the freeze and thaw, the climate up there, is sort of ideal for finding fossils. First off, you know, in places where there's no ice, and those areas are expanding in recent years, in places where there's no ice, the naked bedrock is exposed. So when we look for fossils, we're actually looking for bones that are weathering out on the surface of the rock. And that process of weathering out is aided, actually, by the Arctic environment. There's a freeze-thaw that goes on there. You know, in the winter, it's really, really cold. And in the summer, it's less really, really cold. And so you go from really, really cold to less really cold. And that expands and contracts the rocks. And as it does it, it breaks them up a little bit. And whatever bones are inside the rocks sometimes weather on surface. So the beautiful thing about the Arctic is we can, in the course of a day, walk for miles looking at bedrock and occasionally see bones that are weathering out on the surface. And that's one of the cues that led us to find Tiktaalik in 2004, and that's kind of what we're looking for now.
Neil Shugan, once again, give us the website where people can learn more about you and your books.
Yeah, neilshubin.com, or for a more scientific one, tiktaalik.uchicago.edu, tiktaalik.uchicago, one word, .edu.
And where is that fossil now?
Well, the originals are all going back to Canada, so they're owned by the Canadians and the Inuit people. Right now we're studying on them. There's one batch is with my colleague Ted in Philadelphia, another batch is with me in Chicago. We sort of divide and conquer. I work on the fins, he works on the heads. it works out really well that way. That's why we get along. As soon as we're done those studies, they'll all go back probably about a year and a half.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you, Neil Shubin. He's a paleontologist and science writer affiliated with the University of Chicago, and his book is The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People.
Thanks, Professor.
Thanks so much.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for book and author links, such as today. We also have free audio archives of past programs and digital downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. We return Thursday with a discussion of the University of Miami's South Florida economic impact, as well as Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. And to the calendar, on this day in 1918, 95 years ago, the birth of Arab nationalist leader Gamal Nasser outside Alexandria, Egypt. He died in 1970 of heart failure. Also on this day in 1929, 84 years ago, the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King in Atlanta. He was actually born Michael Luther King. He married Coretta Scott in June of 53. He was assassinated April 4th, 1968. One more while we boast of being bigger than U.S. Steel. On this day in 1983, 30 years ago, the death of mafia brain Meyer Lansky in Miami. A career criminal, he served only 3 months in jail, and that was in 1952. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. He plays with his band this Friday night in Delray Beach. And we leave with a thought from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., quote, "Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.
This is not.